everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week, author Fionnuala Carney explores relationships and marriage in The Book of Love.
I wanted to explore this means of communication within a marriage with longevity, because you can't have many, many years of marriage without the highs and the lows.
We journey to Spain with writer and farmer Chris Stewart.
After 23 years of a gas fridge, which didn't have a light inside it, we were used to it, and it was like a miracle for us to have a fridge that a light came on inside it.
And 20 years since the film version was released, Esther Freud revisits her childhood memoir, Hideous Kinky.
As a child, I held the memories of my time in Morocco, which lasted for a year and a half or so, very, very close.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Fionnuala Carney's first two novels, You, Me and Other People and The Day I Lost You, were Irish Times bestsellers and are both available from the RNIB library. Her third novel, The Book of Love, has now joined them. It's a thoughtful and moving love story, charting the ups and downs of a marriage that no one expects to last. But help is at hand from one of their wedding presents, The Book of Love. Fionnuala Carney joined me in the studio to tell me more. Fionnuala Carney, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
The Book of Love is not only a love story, but it refers to an actual physical book that the young couple, Erin and Dom, are given as a wedding present. Could you just introduce us to The Book of Love?
Yes, I will, and gladly. The Book of Love was a story that has been sort of roaming around my head, in fact, for many years. And I don't know why, because I'm very lucky to still be in love myself with a sort of love affair that has longevity attached to it. But I was always nervous of writing a pure love story. But when I sat down to write The Book of Love, I honestly asked my question, okay, what's the biggest problem that most people have who are together a long time? Because Dom and Erin's story does last over a long time. And the thing that I kept coming back to was communication. That very often when we're in a relationship and one person says one thing, the other is hearing another thing completely different, and it leads to rows and misunderstandings, etc. And I wanted to explore the idea of this couple, if something was difficult to say or something that they knew would lead to misunderstanding, if they could write it down and write it down in the form almost like a love letter, but not, because it's all held in the same book. So it would be, dear Dom, you know, you drove me mad last night because you did X or whatever, and I'm struggling how to say this to you. And the letters, in inverted commas, are always signed in love. So it would be, you know, love, Erin, or whatever. And I wanted to explore this means of communication within a marriage with longevity, because you can't have many, many years of marriage without the highs and the lows. And very often it's the lows that mean, okay, how am I going to say this? How am I going to get this across to the person that I love in a way that they completely understand? So that was the idea behind The Book of Love. And I wanted it, because it's a wedding present, because I wanted it to be something that Erin's father had done in his own marriage. And indeed, Erin might pass on to her own children as an idea.
And the book actually has something rather beautiful embossed on the front of it, doesn't it?
It does. It has the words written by Erin's father to them as a couple. And it says, "What am I? I am the Book of Love. The pages of truth with its light and shade. I am love, and if real, I will never fade."
It's a rather beautiful leather-bound notebook.
Yeah.
In which they can write down, as you say, the things that might be either too difficult to hear or to say, and have the space to be able to express themselves and for the other person to be able to read it without hanging on the next word that's going to come out of their partner's mouth.
Exactly that, because I find, again, in real life, when someone is saying something, even in love, to somebody else, very often the dynamic between a man and a woman is that, you know, and I'm not saying it goes either way gender-wise here, but very often one person is speaking and the other is hearing something and all they want to do is to fix the problem. So there's often a measure of interruption or there's a measure of them hearing something that they think is the answer to the problem. And very often it's not. And I have found, particularly in the writing of this book, that when something is written down and indeed when something is read, it's heard in a different way.
I love the line in the book that says the Book of Love is a route for talking about difficult things rather than ending them.
Yes.
And because you write the book from a now and then perspective, there's a real sense that sometimes there are problems that can't be solved at the time, that you're either not experienced enough or grown up enough to be able to deal with. But actually, when you revisit them a few years later, they become far more clear and far easier to solve.
And very possibly when you're looking back at something, you realise it really wasn't as big as it seemed at the time. When Erin's father gives her and Dom this wedding present, he does give her a few words of advice. And he basically explains that it is to be used for a communication tool and it's to be used in love. And it is also not to be used often because it can't be your only way, which is the point I think you were saying. You know, by all means, introduce this subject, tell the other person how you're feeling. Very often it might mean, in the book certainly, revealing certain things that perhaps one or the other hadn't wanted revealed, but the time comes for honesty and the book is used in that way.
I did wonder why this actually has not become a standard wedding present in the however many thousands of years people have been getting married, because it is such a beautiful and simple idea. What was the inspiration for it?
I think the inspiration is my own relationship, if I'm honest. I have found writing down things, you know, in difficult moments to my husband and vice versa. And I'm not ashamed to admit that he's actually really surprised me when he has done the same back. It's something we only delved into very, very slightly and never again, but it was a very poignant moment for us. And I do think when something is written, it's heard differently. It's funny, you know, even when you're writing a book, I always do what I call a read aloud edit, as well as a sort of an eyeballing edit. And sometimes it's that very moment when I hear something clunky or something that doesn't sound right because I'm actually reading it aloud. And that's sort of similar to me to had I written it down rather than just seeing something.
And the book is told both from Dominic's point of view and from Erin's. And you, I must say, write very convincingly as a man, as well as a woman. And it's a very compelling story. Do you find it easy to write from the male point of view?
Do you know, the strangest thing is I think I find it easier to write from a male point of view. There tends to be similar themes in my books, love, loss, love in all its guises, actually, you know, mother, daughter, father, son, couples, whatever. I actually find it really, really easy to write from a male point of view. I have no idea why. And it's something when I became serious about becoming a proper writer, it was something I was determined to do. For example, in my first book, which is called You, Me and Other People, it was about a betrayal within a relationship. So the complete antithesis, really, of a love story with longevity. But this particular first story was the first time I'd ventured into writing from a male point of view. And he was the betrayer within the betrayal. And I found it really exciting to try and give a wrongdoer's point of view. And I think we're all flawed. And I try and give, not that all the males in my books are the wrongdoers, I hasten to add, but we are all flawed. But I find it easier to get into a male psyche. Isn't that really strange? Yeah, I enjoy writing from a male point of view, and I hope I always do.
And structurally, the book is, as I say, told both in the present and the past, and from a male-female point of view. I wondered if you had a spreadsheet or thousands of yellow post-it notes hanging around your writer's garret. Are you a great planner? Because it struck me as a bit of a juggling act.
It is very much a difficult structure. and one that I struggled with, to be honest, when I was writing. Not with the actual structure itself, but whether it was the right way to portray the book. And for me, it is absolutely the way the story came to me. The now and then perspective was the way the story literally poured into me. And writing from now and then, i.e. the present day being now and then being a sort of a starting point of their meeting and them getting married, and then every year really from then on, it's not easy. But as I said, it's the way that the story came to me, and I hope I pulled it off. And I wonder, have you been to my office and seen all those yellow post-its? Because I am not a spreadsheet girl. I am not a complete planner in that I didn't have everything written out chapter by chapter in a spreadsheet, which might have made my life easier. However, I'm half a pantser and half a planner in that I know the beginning, middle and end. I know the characters and I know most of the form of the book. But I do like the freedom for unusual things or twists and turns or character developments that I hadn't really thought of or expected to come along and knock on the door. And I want to be able to decide to let them in when I'm writing. So I do use post-its. I don't use a spreadsheet. I have a huge whiteboard in my office and I tend to do it almost pictorially. Lots of almost like spidery web type drawings, you know, a centre with arrows coming out and things like that. And that seems to be the way that my brain gets it. But show me a spreadsheet and I'll actually curl up in horror.
I also got the impression that you treat your cast of characters as a group of friends. There was a real sense that you were in the story, that you enjoyed immersing yourself in the relationships between mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, between best friend and sister, and so on and so forth. Is it quite difficult when you get to the end of the book to wipe that whiteboard clean?
It is, very much so. I mean, I have a character hangover when I really write the end, bearing in mind that the final, the end, is only ever written after about maybe 4 or 5 edits. But when you spend, and I spend a year writing a book, so when you spend a year in the heads of these people, they almost become real. And that's how with each particular edit as it goes along as well, there's always a little bit more of character development en route as well. And I miss these people terribly because by the end, I have myself convinced that I'm sure they're real. And I hope that's every writer's hope and dream, that when a reader reads or hears this book, that they have a bit of a book or character hangover as well.
Very much so. And obviously, I mean, you say you give voice to your own characters when you do the read aloud edit, and your books have been turned into audiobooks. Do you have much to do with the choosing of the narrators, or have you listened to the audiobook versions?
I have. It's a bit, again, like listening to myself if I've been interviewed. I sort of have a fear that the narrators chosen won't sound very much like I imagined them in my head. But I've been very lucky, and they have to date. Yes, I've been given choice by the publishers very kindly. For instance, with The Book of Love, I think I had a couple of choices and chose the people that I thought sounded most like the characters. And I think they deliver it well. So, yeah, fingers crossed that your listeners feel the same.
Do you listen to audiobooks much yourself?
I do. And you know what? It's not just a growing phenomenon, I think, out there in the world of publishing. But I think most people who read normally actually are finding a real home in audiobooks now as well. For instance, I was listening to one on the way up on the train. I just find it a really easy, relaxing way of hearing a story told to me. It almost goes back to those days of Jack and Ori, you know, where a story as a child is actually read to you.
Very much so. And actually, it's a very immersive way
of
having grown up reading books and then had to listen to books because I can't read the print anymore. At first, I found it quite a difficult way of listening, but once you just go with the narrator's voice, it is an incredibly immersive way, and I've missed many a railway stop
it's a bit like a favorite movie and maybe having your eyes closed and you know the characters or whatever and you can hear the thing spoken to you. But for me, it's an absolutely increasing format that I'm finding. I find it more relaxing. I don't know whether it's anything to do with just I ache or whatever. But I find actually when I'm listening to a book on Audible or some other audio format that, yes, I can lose myself in it in a different way. And yes, you're right, it's slightly more immersive.
Have you ever been tempted to narrate your own books?
I would like to. Yes, I would like to. I've certainly been tempted. And yes, maybe in the future, I think I might like to try that. The difficulty for me, because I'm not an actor and can't bring the required emotion into something in an audio basis, and I always have at least two points of view in my books, so I would then have to take on the voice and the character of at least a male and a female, or in the book I'm writing at the moment, a male and two females. So I'm not sure I'd be able to do that, if I'm honest. So I think I might need a little bit of help. Maybe narrate one of the voices is the answer.
Exactly. Coming on to what you're writing at the moment, one thing that I thought came through very strongly in the Book of Love is that you write powerfully about both loss and illness or disability. And I was wondering if you had any plans at any point to write about a character with sight loss.
Do you know what? I think maybe it's because I was coming here and you set off this chain reaction in my brain. So the answer is absolutely yes. I have to confess, I hadn't thought about it, but there is room in the book I'm writing at the moment, which I won't give too much away, but this person has a disability. And I was wondering, literally in the last couple of weeks, I've been thinking, I wonder, would it work just as well if that disability was loss of sight? So watch this space.
Well, there you go, tantalising us at the end of the interview. In which case, I will very much look forward to you giving the same thoughtful and emotionally reflective treatment to a character with sight loss as you have to the characters in the Book of Love.
Thank you.
Fionnuala Carney, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and I look forward to speaking to you again in the future about the next book.
Thank you, Red, and very much thank you for having me today.
The Book of Love, narrated by Josie Dunn and Oliver Hembra, is TB 703938. It's available commercially in print, audio and ebook. And Fionnuala will be back at the end of the show with the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, Esther Freud recalls childhood memories of running free in Marrakesh. But first, Chris Stewart was a founder member of the band Genesis, but not for long, and his life now on a remote farm in Andalusia is far from that of a rock star. But he's attracted his own fan base with his books, starting with Driving Over Lemons. He's documented the ups and downs of his chosen way of life. Robert Kirkwood spoke to him via satellite phone.
Thanks, Red. I spoke to Chris Stewart about his books Driving Over Lemons, A Parrot in the Pepper Tree, The Almond Blossom Appreciation Society, Three Ways to Capsize a Boat, and the latest, The Last Days of the Bus Club. The hero of most of those books is the farm itself, El Valero. And when I spoke to Chris, he was relaxing on the deck outside. And of course, to start the interview, I asked him for some level. So the question you often ask is, what did you have for breakfast?
Presumably for level.
Yes.
I have what I have for breakfast every single morning of the year, which is toast and olive oil and tomato and garlic and salt and pepper, and then another piece of toast with some marmalade on it.
All from the garden?
All from the garden. It sets you up for the day.
Now, you're on the terrace of El Valero, the hero farm of the book. So can you tell us what you see? Describe the view you have right now.
What could I see? Well, I'm sitting out on the terrace, as I say, so you can hear the bird song, but there aren't any birds. They've suddenly stopped. They're nervous, I think. So all I can see from here is mountains and rivers and pine trees and the trees on the terrace. And that's when we live really quite a long way out. And so you've got this patch of land here where you cannot see another house from, nor another light at night. And that's one of the great pleasures. So we get the stars and the moon in a way that's really you know, quite rare these days in Europe. There's not that much land as wild as this and as isolated. And we love that. And here it is. And it's green all around the house. It's green, although we've had the driest winter we've had in years. But it's a green oasis here because we happen to have good spring water here.
That happened in the book, actually, the river going past the farm run dry. Has that happened again?
Well, it happens periodically. Southern Spain is a land of droughts over and over again. So this I reckon the main river will dry up this year, and about the third time in 25 years. But it always feels like a sort of cataclysm, you know, because you just rely so... I don't know if you can hear... You can possibly hear a sort of faint susurration in the background. That is the river. And... But, you know, you get so used to it, and it means so much to you. Funnily enough, yesterday I was up in the mountains at the source of our river, right at the head of it. And it waters so much for you when you live in a hot, dry climate like this that's prone to frequent droughts.
Other than the satellite phone we're talking on, what's new at El Valero technology-wise?
Ah, right. OK, well, quite a lot. No, we have faster broadband internet access than friends in London do, believe it or not. And that took time because the first 6 years here, we were without a telephone. I remember now that was one of the episodes when we installed the telephone. All that stuff's true, folks. I'm not capable of making stories up, unfortunately, which is what I'd really like to be able to do. But all I can do is write down what really happens. So what else have we got? We've got that. Things driving over Lemon sold quite a few copies, so we found ourselves a little bit more comfortably off than we were before, and we were able to install some new solar panels. And so now, although all our power comes from solar electricity, we've got a freezer and a fridge, which we're terribly proud of. And the fridge is one of those fridges, when you open the door, an electric light comes on, would you believe? after 23 years of a gas fridge, which didn't have a light inside it, we were used to it. And it was like a miracle for us to have a fridge that a light came on inside it.
Now, and also at the end of the book, we just see Chloe being christened, but I'm assuming she's flown the nest now.
Well, that's right, and that's what the new book that I just published is about. It's about sort of the first book, Driving Over Lemons, is about Chloe being born, and then the next one is her childhood and then her adolescence, and now, well, she's gone. It's just me and Annie left up here alone on the hill.
And through all those books, you do return a lot to your profession of sheep shearing. Do you think that when you first moved into the area that you brought a new farming technology helped your acceptance somewhat?
Oh, without doubt. I mean, first of all, we came here quite early on in that there were not very many other foreigners living here when we arrived. I mean, there were some. We were not the first by any means. But there were very few, and so we were considered to be rather strange in those days. But we were farmers. We'd been farmers in England. We'd had our own flock of sheep, and I'd made a living as a sheep shearer. And therefore, we were interested in all the same things that our neighbours were, and they sort of knew what made us tick, and they could understand what we were about. And also, we spoke a bit of Spanish when we arrived as well. So we were accepted really very warmly and straight away, and we've never, ever had any trouble with that. And then later on, the sheep shearing episode, when I started shearing sheep around here, then I really felt I was part of the area then, and I sort of, you know, became known. And yeah, it was a nice feeling to be involved in that closer way in the place where you live.
Is Domingo still your neighbour?
He is, yes. He's still my neighbour and still my friend and still a big influence on our life, I guess, yeah. And he's... And your next question is he still with Antonia? Is she called Antonia? Yes.
Yes.
And the answer is yes. They are still together after all these years, 15 years now, I think.
And he's not called Domingo, but he's taken on that pseudonym, I think.
Well, that's right. His name is not Domingo at all. It's Matthias. And there's a bit of a story behind that. And that was that as I was writing the first book, I went to him and I said, look, I'm writing this book and you're a character in the book and you're an important part of it. You know, it's a portrait of a friendship. But if you'd like me to change your name, then I'm very happy to do so. But, you know, I'd sort of like to keep your name. And he said, da igual, which means it's all the same to me, which is what the people of the Alfajores say, whatever you ask them. And he said this over and over again, because I go back and forth every now and then and talk to him about it. He said, no, just do what you want. And then just at the sort of last moment, he came to me one day and he said, Cristobal, I want my name changed. I've heard from somebody that I'm going to get into a lot of trouble because of what you put in this book. And I said, well, who have you been talking to? He said, never you mind. He said, I've just been talking to someone in a bar who said this could be a real big problem for me. So I want everything changed. I want my name changed and the name of my family and the farm and everything. So I said, well, look, I said I'd be happy to do it. Of course, I'll do it. But I said, I'm very disappointed because, you know, portrait of a friendship, and I'd like to have your real name. Doesn't matter. Take it out. So I changed the name of his farm, I changed the name of his mother, I changed the name of his father, I changed the name of his dog, I changed his name. But of course everybody knew exactly who it was because he's my neighbour and he's the guy I used to go sheep shearing with, so everybody here knows who he is. And I called him Domingo, I thought that's a really nice name. Anyway, shortly after that, he didn't hit the big time, but I think in the second book, in The Parrot and the Pepper Tree, it describes how he learns sculpture from his girlfriend, Antonia, because she's a sculptress. And he's got amazingly good, I mean, a terrific talent at sculpture. And he's been selling sculpture all over the place in Andalusia, in a gallery in Granada. And he signs himself Domingo. So I thought there's a nice irony to that.
Another phrase, you mentioned the phrase he used when he said it's all the same to me. Another phrase that pops up in the book a lot that perhaps needs a bit of an explanation is in vinegar.
I knew you were going to say that. It's considered pretty rare in Spain, actually. You know, when I've used that in other places in Spain, people are not familiar. There's a startled look on their faces. I think it's not just Alpujarra, but I think it's peculiar to this valley and a few of the population of this valley. It's a great expression. It's absolutely meaningless, but it sort of, you know, it gets the idea across.
Now, in your second book, you do talk about your time in the band Genesis. I wasn't going to mention this, but there was a recent reunion documentary on TV. Why weren't you in it?
Well, they didn't ask me. I think, I'm sure you know the story. I mean, they very sensibly threw me out, asked me to leave, so it says on the Wikipedia page, which is probably the wisest move they ever made. And I guess I must have been pretty upset at the time, but I don't remember that, because one doesn't remember things like that. And I bear them no ill will. No, I wasn't a part of it. I was, you know, this is a long time ago. We're talking about when I was 15, 16 years old, and I was a kid, a schoolboy drummer, and a crap drummer at that. So I think, you know, they really wanted to erase all memory of that from their minds.
Have any of them visited you on the farm?
Yes. Tony Banks came to lunch once. You know, I bump into them from time to time, but our paths very pretty rarely cross, as you can imagine. It's a rather different lifestyle.
Now, a large part at the end of the book was the rebuilding of your bridge. Have you put some of your royalties towards building a permanent one?
No. Well, no, I'm lying. We haven't built a motor bridge because we've decided we never want that. We only want a footbridge because we don't want cars coming across this side. We can get across because we have a four-wheel drive that goes through the river, but it's only a Ford, and most of the year you can't cross it. But we have built a better bridge, and we did actually invest a little bit of money in the bridge this time. I think it cost us about €1,000 in cement and steel and stuff. But this is the first time we've ever used concrete and steel in a bridge, and it's higher above the river than ever before. And so when we finished it, I looked at it and I said, this bridge will last us the rest of our lives. We won't ever have to build another bridge. And then, of course, about 3 weeks later, I went down there one day and the water was licking the bridge. And I thought, Jesus, you should never say a thing like that. Not that it bothers us, really, because we sort of like to be cut off. It's a great pleasure to it. You know, we're not going to starve to death. We've got plenty of food in the larder. And we really feel the rest of the world is cut off from us rather than us from the rest of the world. And we like it that way. It's nice. It's peaceful. And all those things that you feel you ought to do but you haven't got round to doing, well, it doesn't matter. You can't do them because you're stuck here and there's nowhere you can go. And it's great.
The next thing I knew, there was a whistling outside and the door burst open with a resounding crash. Manolo stood there with a slightly bemused smile. ¿Estás escribiendo? You're writing. Well, I'm trying to. What are you at down there? I've ploughed the stable field and sown it with grass. Have you harrowed it? No, I'll bring the mules tomorrow for that. And I've watered the alfalfa. The pipes were blocked, so I had to dismantle them all to get the muck out. Clogged solid they were. It's that wind. It filled the acacia with sticks and leaves and oleander petals, and they all got sucked into the pipe. When are you going to make that filter you keep talking about? I'm sorry, I'll see if I can get round to it tomorrow. Bueno. And I've rearranged the haystack and fixed the ram's water drinker and tied up the tomatoes. I looked at the piece of paper before me on the desk. Manolo was edging forward, trying to catch a glimpse of my morning's work. I covered it with my arm. Manolo surveyed the room. Lots of books, he observed. Yes, I suppose there are. How's your book coming along, then? I looked down at my desk and thought of Manolo's awesome morning's achievements. On the piece of paper was written, Chapter 1, Arrive at El Valero. I took my pen and added a full stop. Not bad, I lied. Not bad.
Now, that was a clip of you reading Parrot in the Pepper Tree. I know we've played Nigel Graham's reading of Driving Over Lemons, the one that's available in the RNIB Talking Books library, but you've actually read all of your books unabridged yourself. How did you find that process?
Oh, I love it. Actually, I really like it. Because with the first book, my editor, Nat, who's a great friend, who was a friend long before she was my editor and has remained through thick and thin my friend, because it's a very tumultuous sort of relationship, as you can imagine, author and editor.
Mm.
She said, well, they want to make an audiobook of your book. Isn't that great? And I said, yeah. I said, do you think I could read it? And she said, don't be so damn silly. It's an actor's job. You know, you've got to be proper trained to do that. So don't let such foolish thoughts enter your head. And I said, oh, okay, it's just a thought. And she said, well, I'll ask them. And so she rang them up and said, well, you would like to read it. They said, oh, we love it. Oh, it's much the best thing if an author reads his book. So I went along and read it, and it wasn't very difficult. I wrote it, for Christ's sake. It wasn't very difficult at all. And it was money for old rope. And it was a really nice thing. They put me up in a studio. They gave me really nice sandwiches for lunch. And then they said I wasn't allowed a beer at lunchtime or any alcoholic drinks at all because their microphones are so sensitive that they pick up the sort of slobbering of the lips that comes after a beer. No, it was a nice little number. And so now I've read all five of them. I guess I'm getting quite good at it, even though I say it myself.
There's a man on the telephone, said Anna. I think he's called Leaf of the Mail. He says he wants to speak to you. Seems an odd sort of name, I muttered, and we both looked at the telephone as if it might hold some sort of clue. But by the time I picked up the receiver, the line was dead. Then, of course, it dawned on me. It was the journalist, Leaf, of the Mail on Sunday. My book had just been published in England, and, to Anna's particular disbelief, had not disappeared without trace. In fact, on the back of a couple of nice reviews and the reading on Radio 4, it had been charging up into the non-fiction book charts. It was then that Leith had phoned up and said he wanted to do a story, and he'd be coming out to talk to us at our home in Spain. "I'll just get a car at Malaga," he had said, blithely dismissing my attempts to warn him of the perils in store, "and I'll see you very soon." He probably thinks he knows where we live because of that map in the front of the book, said Anna. You know, the one that you drew. I began to feel a bit guilty about my handiwork. The drawings of eucalyptus and olive groves, where perhaps a track or turning might have been more descriptive. I hadn't actually considered that anyone would use the map in the book. It had been more of a Swallows and Amazon sort of thing.
How do you see yourself? Would you describe yourself as a writer or a farmer?
Well, it depends who I'm with, really. I mean, if I'm with farmers, I describe myself as a writer, and if I'm with writers, I describe myself as a farmer. But I've written five books now, so and I've made a living out of it for the last 15 years, so I guess. And the farm doesn't make us any. The farm gives us a quality of life rather than, you know, it's just one. It's like a boat, really. It's a hole into which we pour money. But it gives us a wonderful quality of life living here. And I farm. I'm not a very good farmer. I'm a bit of a crap farmer, really. I love farming passionately, but I'm not very good at it. Writing, yep, I love writing too. So, yeah, I'm a writer, I guess.
Could you have stayed on the farm without the books?
Well, it's a good question. I think we would have done. I know we would have done because I can't see any alternative. We burned our boats and spent everything on the farm. I guess we'd have found other ways of making a living. We'd have survived, but it would have been harder, much harder than it is. It's made, you know, we still live in the same place, and we love living here, and our lifestyle hasn't changed an awful lot, but it's much more comfortable and much easier.
One of the great cultural contributions given by Spain to the world is the Carmen. Now, a true Carmen is an enclosed patio garden on the hill of the Albaicín in Granada, and to qualify for the name, it must have a view of the Alhambra and the peaks of the Sierra Nevada beyond. Apart from that, a number of essential elements can be deployed more or less at random. These include grapevines, tall, slender cypresses, orange and lemon trees, a persimmon or two, perhaps a pomegranate, and myrtle, whose scent was believed by the Moors to embody the very essence of love. The surface of a Carmen should be cobbled in the style known as El Empedrado Granadino, a grey and white pattern, again devised by the Moors, using the river stones that occur in abundance throughout the province. There should also be a fountain and a pool, and preferably a number of runnels and rills, leading the water hither and thither in a fashion perfectly conceived to make you feel cool and contemplative on a hot summer's day. If the thing has been done right, the interplay between light and shade, the mingling scents of the flowers and the chuckling of the water in its channels will induce a profound contentment and sense of peace as you wander the cobbled paths, perhaps hand in hand with a good friend, musing playfully, the pair of you, upon the mysteries of the universe.
Thanks to Chris Stewart and to Robert Kirkwood. And listen out for Driving Over Lemons, coming soon to RNIB's Talking Books show. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, the books of Fionnuala Carney's life. But before that, Esther Freud was 4 when her mother took her and her sister to live in Morocco. It was an experience that, a quarter of a century later, inspired her best-selling book, Hideous Kinky. The film version, starring Kate Winslet, was released 20 years ago in spring 1999. Like the novel, it follows Esther and her sister as they explore the exotic backstreets of Marrakesh, while their mother seeks self-fulfillment through meditation and Sufism.
The book has a wonderful bubbling feel to it, as if the story needed to be told. Did it write like that?
That's very interesting. It did need to be told, for me anyway. As a child, I held the memories of my time in Morocco, which lasted for a year and a half or so, very, very close. And when I came back to England, I was 6. And for those next few years, living a much more traditional life in England, which seemed quite kind of grey and subdued compared to my North African experience, I felt people wouldn't know when they looked at me that I had this extraordinary story inside me. First, when I arrived back, my hair had been hennaed and it was quite orange and long and scraggly, and I had henna patterns on my hands. So people did know I was different, but slowly these things wore off. And I used to tell people, in Morocco, and my nickname at school became In Morocco, and I couldn't ever quite get them to understand how amazing it really was. So when I was 26, I sat down and I wrote what became Hideous Kinky, and it really freed me. It really freed me to be more present in the world. It was a really important thing that I did for myself.
Were the memories close to the surface? Were they that vivid?
The reason why it took me as long as it did to write it was because I didn't have enough memories to fill a book. I didn't know then what I know now about writing is no one knows everything that's going to go into a book when you start. It's what puts people off. But if you start, it's a bit like chipping away at a surface of a stone and there's something beautiful underneath. You remember more things or you have more ideas. I had a real breakthrough moment with it. And I was struggling. I started the idea really when I was about 22. So it took about 4 years for me to actually have the confidence and the discipline to sit down and write it. And one of the pieces of advice I got along the way was make it up. And that was because I was getting stuck and doing strange, complicated structural flashbacks, older child looking back. And I said, I can't make it up. It's my life. I don't remember enough to write a book, but I want to put these very vivid memories that I do have down. And she said, just try. You're allowed to do anything, you know. Give yourself permission. So I just wrote the first page, which is still the first page, became the first page of the book, right there and then. And it was these little children in a van travelling through Europe, heading for Morocco, which is what happened, but I have no memory of that. But I got the spirit of it. And then I started to think, it's just the spirit of the story that I need. And the details, well, who's to really remember exactly what every detail was? But there's a lot of things in there that are true and many things that are true that didn't get into the book.
I wonder if having a 4-year-old narrator who everything is new to, so she can't be judgmental, and she is the ultimate innocent abroad. She can't read, write, speak the language. She doesn't even have a name. And so she's not passing judgment. She's just observing. Was that liberating as a writer, or did you find the naivety actually quite difficult discipline to stay within?
So interesting to hear it expressed like that. None of those things occurred to me when I started to write. I was thinking of my sort of 4 or 5-year-old self, this height that she was. I have actually one photograph from that stage of my childhood, and it's a face, the eyes looking up into the camera, many Moroccan beads around her neck, my neck, and some bunches with sort of English ribbon and a little kaftan. And that was who was telling the story. And I looked at that photo and I told it from her perspective without any of the critical analytical thoughts that you've just presented, which are completely true and right. But when it was published, people said, how extraordinary to write a novel from the point of view of such a young child. And I thought, oh, I was just setting it down as it happened. I wasn't a writer. And I hadn't studied English literature. I left school when I was 16 and studied drama. And I was never very academic, or certainly one thing I knew from the age of about 12 is I didn't want to go to university. So I was also, like my nameless narrator, new to this world. And it came very instinctively and naturally. And I found, oh, I wanted to tell stories. I thought I was going to tell stories through acting. It turns out I'm going to tell stories through writing, and that was it. I'm now on my 9th novel.
Absolutely, and they just get better and better. I love Hideous Kinky, and it was a wonderful first novel and a wonderful introduction to you. It's also a hymn to sisterhood, and I think my favourite part, actually, is when the two sisters gang up on one of their mum's more useless suitors, Pedro Patchbottom. And, of course, it's got that element of all great children's books, that it's the children against the mess that the adults have made. Did you write it with any children's books that were favourites of yours in mind, any children's authors?
I was definitely influenced by books like Little House on the Prairie, and there's a wonderful biography by Patricia Lynch, who's a wonderful children's writer, an Irish writer, Brogine and the Green Shoes, and she wrote a book about her own childhood. And those books really inspired me because I saw what I was doing as a child. In order to create some kind of semblance of maybe safety and sanity, I was always making stories up for myself out of what chaos was actually happening around me. And I saw that that's what those writers were doing with their own childhoods in different ways, making what was going on into a story and somehow exerting some kind of control over it. Not that I was thinking those things now then, but I see that's what I was doing and why those books appealed to me so much.
And of course, your narrator makes up stories to comfort her sister. And also she has recurring nightmares about the Black Hand herself, which you are Sigmund Freud's granddaughter. In some ways, were you trying to analyse an uncanny and upsetting incident in your own childhood then, do you think? Or was it a happier time than that?
I wasn't trying to analyse anything. I did have an absolute terror of the Black Hand. It was my fear, so I just used it. I just threw it in. I mean, I can see looking back, of course, you know, children are frightened. I mean, my own daughter, who has had a pretty stable life compared to mine, wouldn't go upstairs for years because she thought there was a monster under the bed. Children's imaginations are so vivid. It's so incredible. And I wasn't frightened of the Black Hand when I wasn't frightened of it. But when I was, it was so powerful. I couldn't move. And that haunted me for many years, actually. My memories of being particularly frightened are more when I was about 9. But I remember first hearing the story when I was about 5. So I used that without any thought that I was reflecting. But of course, instinctively as a writer, you're making light and shade all the time. There's wonderful, intoxicating, exciting adventures. And then, of course, just in order for the story to have an ebb and flow, you think, well, hang on, let's put the dark side in. I read a wonderful quote by Stendhal which said, think very hard about what you want to say in this book and try your hardest not to say it. And what I was doing when I was writing that book was staring at the sheet of paper. And I actually was sitting at my kitchen table with a sheet of paper and a pen. And I thought, I want to breathe into this story all the joy, extraordinary excitement, terror and insecurity that happened on that journey without ever saying that that's what's happening. And I just said, then we went to the lake. I left the reader to imagine all those other things.
And actually, rereading the book now, when I first read it, I didn't have children, and I think I had quite a lot of sympathy with the mother who was fed up with the constraints of living in Tunbridge Wells and wanted some colour in her life. And now rereading it with children of my own, I worry for their safety and think, the woman's so irresponsible. Did you find your own views of the events that went into the story have changed since you yourself became a mum?
I actually feel like I had exactly the opposite reaction to you. When I was writing the book, I did feel quite critical at times and quite sort of shocked by the sheer reality of what we all went through. But once I had children and the relentless sameness and boredom of it at times, much as I adored looking after them, I thought, God, good for mum. You know, she had so little money, so little security, and was quite ostracised from her own family and separated from our father. I mean, what does she have to lose? Good for her. I'm so proud of her.
Back in 1967, her children could even have been taken into care if she had been unfortunate. I guess, you know, things have changed a lot in the intervening years.
Yes, I think when my mother was incredibly supportive of me writing the book, and when she read it, she was very proud. But when the reviews came out and sort of said that she was irresponsible, you know, this mother is irresponsible and feckless, etc., she thought, no, I was sent off to boarding school when I was tiny. You know, just as you say, she came from a strict Catholic family who may well have had us taken away if they even knew we existed, and they didn't know we existed for some years. So I don't, if I could write the book again, and I would like to write all my books again, ideally, because they're never quite perfect when you have a chance to look back, I would have given maybe a little bit more of the reality of the background. But then again, as a very young narrator, I was trying to be true to what the child actually knew, and I didn't know that.
And actually, I think at the end of the book, the mother doesn't come out as careless of her children's well-being. She is just feeling her own way. And I one of the things that comes through the book is just how young she is as well.
When I was involved in the making of the film, I didn't have a huge amount of input, but I did really insist that the actress who played the mother was very young. And in fact, Kate Winslet was only about 21 when she made the film, but she's always been a very sort of womanly young girl when she was. And she was absolutely fantastic, and she gave that quality of someone very earthy but curious.
It is a fantastic book. To any of the listeners who haven't read it, I thoroughly recommend it, and the rest of Esther Freud's books as well, which are available from the Talking Books Library.
Did you read it, or did you listen to the audiobook? I'm curious.
I listened to the audiobook that's in the RNIB Talking Books Library, which is beautifully read.
I'm so proud of that, because Kate Winslet was meant to do it, and at the last minute they said, oh, she can't do it, she's too busy launching Titanic. I went, oh, I'll do it. So I'm always very proud that I did do that.
Hideous Kinky, written and narrated by Esther Freud, is TB12097. Have you discovered a book that beautifully evokes another time and place? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now it's back to Fionnuala Carney for the books of her life. Fionnuala, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes. I think there were many, obviously, and it's like being asked to choose your favourite child, really. Can you choose your favourite book? But it helps that you've asked me just from certain eras. And I think, although, like many children, I was a child of Enid Blyton and Aslan the Lion and Swallows and Amazons and things like that, I think the first book that I remember really affecting me,
I read as a teenager, probably late teens, probably actually sort of A-level time, and it was Wuthering Heights. And I absolutely love Wuthering Heights. I know that there are many people out there who think of it as a Marmite book. But if I'm honest, I think that although when I read it the first time, I wasn't aware that it was going to affect my life as a writer, when I look back in hindsight, it definitely has. It has such common themes. It has love, loss. It has the whole upstairs, downstairs thing. I love, for instance, the sense of place in the moors. It's almost like a character itself in the book. And I love that idea that the location where a story is being set can almost become alive as well in a book. So for me, yes, that time when I was late teens, it was that love story, that really fractured and difficult love story between Cathy and Heathcliff, which has so much love and loss attached to it, and obsession and vanity and all sorts of common themes that we find in literature. But I remember it made me feel, I can't say it made me cry, but it made me feel this aching sadness for both of the characters. And I think that's something that probably subconsciously I try to emulate in the characters I write about today.
"Well, Mr. Earnshaw," she cried, "I wonder what you'll have a get next. Are we going to murder folk on our very doorstones? I see this house will never do for me. Look at the poor lad, he's fair choking. Whisht, whisht, you can go on so. Come in, and I'll cure that. There now, hold you still." With these words, she suddenly splashed a pint of icy water down my neck and pulled me into the kitchen. Mr. Heathcliff followed, his accidental merriment expiring quickly in his habitual moroseness. I was sick exceedingly, and dizzy and faint, and thus compelled, perforce, to accept lodgings under his roof.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB16036, narrated by Michael Kitchen. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, it's a book that I've read a couple of times, and indeed on a rainy day, if I had time again, I'd read it again. And it's called 1,000 Splendid Suns by the wonderful writer Khaled Hosseini. And he does something which, again, subconsciously, I think, might have sort of tried to mirror itself in my writing, in that he's a male and he writes from a female perspective. And he does it so well when I'm listening to his books, both The Kite Runner, his first novel, and the second one, the one I'm talking about, 1,000 Splendid Suns, are set in war-torn Afghanistan. And 1,000 Splendid Suns tells the story of two women who are a generation apart. Although they're not related, it very much is a mother and daughter relationship. Mariam is the eldest and Layla is the younger one. And with the background of the culture and the arrival of the Taliban in war-torn Afghanistan, it's a love story. It's a love story between mother and daughter figures, and I use that in italics. It's a love story that spans a long time. It's a story that uncovers such, again, losses, both from a sort of a loss of people point of view, but a loss of freedom point of view. There's huge differences between male and females in the worlds that they live in, and one having more chances than the other. There's so much covered in this book, and he does the characterisation of women so well. I urge people to listen to his work, really. He's fabulous.
Mariam was 5 years old the first time she heard the word harami. It happened on a Thursday. It must have, because Mariam remembered that she had been restless and preoccupied that day, the way she was only on Thursdays, the day when Jalil visited her at the Kolba. To pass the time until the moment that she would see him at last, crossing the knee-high grass in the clearing and waving, Mariam had climbed a chair and taken down her mother's Chinese tea set. The tea set was the sole relic that Mariam's mother, Nana, had of her own mother, who had died when Nana was 2. Nana cherished each blue and white porcelain piece, the graceful curve of the pot's spout, the hand-painted finches and chrysanthemums, the dragon on the sugar bowl, meant to ward off evil.
1,000 Splendid Suns by Khaled Hosseini is available in Braille, giant print and as TB15624, which is narrated by Di Langford. Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend to the Read On listeners?
Yes, and it's one I'm planning to read as an audiobook, but I have been lucky enough to read it before because I know the writer quite well, and she has come to the world with this debut, and it's called The Truths and Triumphs of Grace Atherton. And it's just a fantastic story. Anstie Harris, who is the writer, this is her debut, and honestly, people will not really think of it as a debut when they hear it first time. It tells the story of Grace, who is a very talented musician and who, for reasons which I won't spoil, no longer plays, but she runs a music shop, and she's now become a very talented instrument maker. And she has a love affair with a man called David, who lives in France. And again, without spoiling things, she's been with this man a very, very long time, and things go horribly wrong. And from the moment of it going horribly wrong, I think the tagline is Grace falls out of love and into life. And it's just a wonderful story of unusual friendships and the way that when you think that everything is just disastrous, the way that life can give you an incredible uplift. And the book does the same. So again, I know it's out on audiobook, so yes, have a listen to The Truths and Triumphs of Grace Atherton.
The Truths and Triumphs of Grace Atherton by Anstie Harris is on sale now in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Tanya Rodriguez. Fionnuala Carney, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for reading.
Oh, thank you.
And for being a guest on Read On. Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale. That's REDSZELL. And producer Robert is at talking_books. So farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.